Service Project, a collection of public service origin stories. I'm Kate Dallaire, and I'm connecting with current and former public servants, one human and one story at a time. We're thinking through why we chose careers in service and what we've learned along the way. Today, I have the privilege of speaking with Brad Brooks Rubin. Brad is a partner at the boutique sanctions and anti-money laundering and regulatory-focused law firm, Arcturus?
You got it.
Oh, I should have just trusted myself. A firm where all six of his other partners also served in federal or state governments. Brad has served twice at the State Department, most recently in the Office of the Sanctions Coordinator, and previously in the Economics Bureau working on conflict diamonds and conflict minerals. He also served as a lawyer for the sanctions agency OFAC at Treasury and helped lead an NGO called The Sentry and held other roles in the private sector. Brad likes to say he's been his own multi-stakeholder initiative, but does his dream work on the side as a radio DJ on WOWD LP and music writer on the Substack, 3 albums, 6 old guys. Brad, thank you so much for being here with me today.
It's such a privilege. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's my privilege to talk with you. And so I want to start by hopping in our time machine and zooming back to your childhood. Was there someone or something that sparked your interest in government, or did you just kind of find your way into this work?
As I zoom back, I think I end up on a Sunday morning visiting my maternal grandparents. My maternal grandfather in particular was obsessed with politics and current events, and I grew up in the 80s, and so he was focused on his real hatred for Ronald Reagan and his real obsessive love of the state of Israel, though he never went. So like many folks of his generation, he was kind of super left when it came to domestic policy and super right wing when it came to Israel. So I grew up and every week, every Sunday, we would go visit my grandparents. I grew up in southeastern Pennsylvania, actually just pretty close to Wes Rist, if anybody listened to that amazing episode you did with Wes. So I grew up near him and we would go visit my grandparents. And, you know, I was like 8, 9 showing up for Sunday to watch football and hang out with my grandparents. And there would be a stack of articles that he had clipped for me and underlined and highlighted. And I would spend the first hour just like getting his lecture on.
It was a briefing book, really. He had a briefing book for you.
It was a briefing book, exactly. And he had prepared extensive talking points. They had not been, you know, let's say, cut during the clearance process. He had a lot to say. You know, this was a real era where lots was changing. And so what I remember also is, you know, I was sort of listening, I guess. And I'm an only child, so there wasn't anyone else to sort of take the fray. And so I internalized all that. And then I would go to school, and I remember doing lots of projects when I was a kid. And they would always just filter into current events and public affairs. I would sort of do art projects, and I was terrible at art, but I would do art projects where I would like draw a Pac-Man game. I remember where like the Pac-Man was Ronald Reagan and the ghosts were, you know, workers and, you know, taxes and all these kinds of things. And like, I was 9, I had no
taxes.
Idea what I was really talking about,
but like,
that's what he would, you know, so like I was internalizing all of that. So I was always on this path towards like public affairs, foreign affairs, foreign policy. You know, I remember just thinking always in school I would be a lawyer. I don't remember doing a lot of research on what that meant or what serving in government meant. I remember, you know, I listened carefully to Judd Devermont's episode, and you know, Judd may or may not have read in a book that he was going to be about being a desk officer at the State Department, and that sort of drove him. And then his dad pointed him to intelligence. So I don't remember having any, like, this is the thing I want to do in government. And my parents weren't interested in government or public affairs or foreign policy. So I didn't have that guidance. And, you know, it was pre-internet, so you couldn't just sort of figure out where things were. But I was always on that trajectory. I studied Middle East in college. So again, like kind of directed by my grandfather in many ways, sort of picked up Middle East policy. And that's kind of what I assumed I would do. I'll say when I got to law school, without really thinking that much about it, and I would, you know, public service announcement, To anyone thinking about going to law school, take your time and think about it. I know you said you worked for a law firm for a long time to be sure that's exactly the right thing to do. So I went too quickly to law school. It's worked out fine for me, but take your time. And I had the really important experience of stumbling into the Office of Public Interest and Community Service at Georgetown, where I went, and an amazing mentor there who's still there, Lauren Dubin, connected me with a program where I had the opportunity to spend both of my summers of law school in the West Bank and also in Northern Israel working on human rights issues. And in that first year, it was a program called the Palestine Peace Project, and it took lawyers and law students. This was 1997, so a time when everyone was hopeful and thought things were going to be changing. So there were 20 of us lawyers, law students, who were going to go kind of build the future. And I was the only Jewish person on the program. And it really became life-changing, both in terms of what it opened up about understanding realities that you haven't been exposed to. Like, my grandfather had passed away by then, but I so wished I had been able to bring him to see what he hadn't learned about and what he had missed, frankly, in his understanding of the situation there.
Or what wasn't covered in the articles.
Correct. Yeah. The articles were not getting to that, or they were covered and he just assumed they were all lies. Right. Because I grew up, you know, during the first Intifada, and I remember any number of articles where he would say, this isn't true and that's not true. And I had the opportunity to go and be there and live in Ramallah and go to work in East Jerusalem and realize some of it's true. A lot of it's true. But I was the only Jewish person on the program, and I wasn't I wasn't particularly religiously affiliated or observant at the time. That experience made me become more so. But being the only Jewish person in this program, where I was both kind of understanding what was wrong locally, what was wrong happening, what was wrong about what was happening with the occupation and Israeli policy on one hand, and then hearing the other people on my program sort of take it in all kinds of different directions and having to say, okay, hang on, like, I see that there's things wrong here, but let's think about this from other perspectives. And it really taught me kind of being a voice amid lots of other voices that can take things in different directions. So
and that's diplomacy, really, like seeing it from all the angles.
And I've never thought about it until preparing for this podcast and your good questions, frankly. But I often say that experience, and it was led by a guy named Joe Zogby, who still works on the Hill and, you know, has taught me a lot. And I often think what I learned on that program was, you know, about the situation itself. But as I've reflected on it, it actually, it taught me about diplomacy, about understanding situations for yourself, really. And being afraid to be wrong, being afraid to deal with really hard and uncomfortable realities, and being able to admit that there's a lot of things here I don't know, and there's a lot of things here that are wrong, and we have to work together in different and maybe challenging ways to solve them, which is also a big part of policy.
Yeah. And holding space for two things to be true that seem dissonant, but maybe they're equally true. That's really hard for anyone, I think.
Yeah, it was my first exposure to that. I know you've talked about that with a number of guests over time, when people have that experience. And that was really my first exposure. And it was the hardest, because this was my identity. It was my family's identity. And I was now confronting it face to face. I was in taxis every day, crossing the checkpoints. Again, as a Jewish person, you know, this was a time when you could do that. Now it's sort of hard to imagine that happening. But I could get into a Palestinian shared taxi and go from Ramallah to Jerusalem. And to the checkpoint soldiers, they didn't know I was an American Jewish guy. I just looked like everybody else to some degree. And being the other is a really important experience, like experiencing how your community to some degree, because I was more affiliated with the Israeli soldier to a degree than the Palestinians I was in a car with. But learning that experience of how the other is actually viewed by your own community was really powerful for me. And again, something I have tried to bring through in my kind of public service experience. So, I mean, the last thing I'll say maybe on this part is just, I finished law school and was really, had my eyes opened and wanted to kind of continue serving in human rights or public service again. I didn't really have a sense of what government life was like at that stage, But here I was in this sort of very hard but interesting and exciting context. And my mentors at the jobs I had in those summers both said, again, maybe it's apocryphal, but I have the memory of hearing, we have a lot of people who want to help and very few who can. Go to a law firm, get trained, learn how to be a lawyer, and then you'll figure out how to help us and help the context here. And I've also tried to always kind of learn and gain skills before I sort of jump in and say, here I am, I'm here to help. And so I went to a law firm and was on a 6-year path before I ended up in government.
And when you were at the law firm, how did you feel about it? Like, were you all in, or were you kind of discovering what you liked and didn't like about the work?
Yeah, I was definitely all in is not the phrase I would use. It was a good, I think I've learned more about that experience in retrospect than when I was in it. I was,
I
told, the people in the public interest community service office and everyone, like, 2 years maximum, I'm not going to be more than 2 years at a law firm. And then I'm going to find my path of serving human rights and community. And then, I met a girl and we had different plans. Once we got married, she went on a path. She was I'll probably talk about her later, but, a public servant herself at the time at the State Department and wanted a change. And so we moved to Philadelphia, and staying at the law firm became what was necessary. I think two things that I learned at the time from the law firm. One was I got to the firm and identified, what is it that I'm going to be most interested in here, and what's going to feel least problematic to me. The firm worked with some clients who I just knew I couldn't work with, and they were the most, if you wanted to rise to the top of the firm, like, that's the work you had to do. So I found a small practice that was international trade, a lot of customs work, some sanctions work, and it was very client directed. And so I had that idea in mind, like, I need to learn. I need to be directly working with clients. I need to take what those folks had said to me in Israel and Palestine of, like, learn how to help us. So I want to have hands-on experience. I want to be doing things directly. And I want to work on things that don't keep me up at night. And so that was this small practice. And so that taught me, it's okay to not, at the time the firm had a brochure that we would hand out, and the practice wasn't even on the brochure. Like, most people didn't even know we did that work. But I found it rewarding. The direct work with clients was really important. I did learn a lot. I learned how to manage my own projects and interface with clients. And I also learned that what's important to me and what's not. We talked about it as we were preparing, and it's sort of the story that resonates for me is we did a lot of customs work. And some of that work related to, when you buy a product in the store and it says made in, like, there are rules about what country you're allowed to say the product is made in, because it's complicated in supply chains, et cetera. So we had this project where a frying pan manufacturer wanted to say made in a European country, which sounded more like cuisine. And the truth of their manufacturing process was that some of it was made there and some of it was made in Southeast Asia, which made sense. But they didn't want the frying pan to say made in Southeast Asian country. And the legal analysis was actually super complicated and interesting. And my boss was really excited about it, like the research and the way, and what about this and what about that? And I just remember thinking, like, I didn't go to law school, and I'm not going to devote to frying pans. Like, this is a really interesting question, and I don't care what the answer is. It was a moment of thinking, like, I want to do work where I care what the answer is, where I'm invested in the answer, not in just in the process. And my boss was really somebody who loved the process of the work and the thinking, and whether it was frying pans or something else, he didn't care. And, I think realizing, like, I need to care about what I'm doing, and also not judging him. There's a famous music producer, who said is quoted, maybe it's also apocryphal, but is quoted as saying something along the lines of, like, when I hear music I don't like, I wonder what's wrong with me that I don't understand what that artist was going for. Like, what is it? This artist, this was the most important thing to this artist, and they produce something. And there is a part of it that's like, I can think it's bad because it's just not performed well, but like, what am I missing? What in me is missing that I'm not connecting with what this person did? And I only heard that after I had left the firm, but I sort of reflected on it as that was my old boss. And there's lots of people in the world who are working on things and I'm not going to judge them for it. I learned at that point, like, that's not where I want to be.
For sure. And it's easier to think about when it's like frying pans, but when you get into other issues, especially in public service, I think for so many people who might be listening to this show and thinking about what their next chapter holds, like, I struggled with this too, because sometimes there are issues that feel a lot more meaningful than frying pans, and they're still not maybe the issues that speak to you. And you might think that was going to be the issue that would speak to you, but it just doesn't. And it doesn't mean that it's not important, and it doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with you. It might just mean that's not your calling, or whatever word you want to use for it. But like, I really do believe that we have unique gifts and we're on a journey to try to discover where we can be most impactful. And frying pans were not it for you. And you know what, Brad, I hope that's not keeping you up at night.
No. I do look carefully when I pick up a frying pan. Where was this made?
You're where? And that, now I'm going to research it.
Yeah. But okay. Maybe, so, are you sure it was made in France? Because I don't know for
now
sure.
Now you never know. So don't pay extra if it says it was made in Europe.
Yeah.
Okay. So you finally ended up breaking into public service.
Yep.
As an Office of Foreign Assets Control, OFAC lawyer at Department of Treasury. What were you working on there?
So, As I've talked about, I was really focused on the Middle East. I'd studied it in college. I'd lived there. And so I show up and I get really lucky to get a job in the chief counsel's office for OFAC. And I show up on the first day and like, I really want to work on sanctions related to the Middle East. And they say, kind of in classic government fashion, great, I need you to work on Africa. and I was sort of like, are you sure? And it was like, that's where the need is. And so you do what you need to do. Mm-hmm. And again, sort of, you know, these moments that sort of change your life, like that experience living in the West Bank that opened up a lot of different perspectives. My entire career has changed, and I couldn't be more grateful to my boss at the time for saying, I need you to work on this. So I ended up, the OFAC, we can get into sanctions for geeks later. But sanction is sort of, OFAC is divided functionally, but the legal team is divided by program. So you handle all aspects of a specific sanctions program. So I was working on Darfur, the first time there was genocide in Sudan, sadly. We had comprehensive sanctions on Sudan, and we were also doing things related to Darfur, specifically Liberia, Cote d'Ivoire, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Zimbabwe. And again, in a thing that ended up kind of changing a lot of my career, OFAC has a small piece of implementing something called the Kimberley process for conflict diamonds.
Yep.
So that was also part of my portfolio. And so I just spent the next few years learning how sanctions work, but also learning a lot about Africa policy, conflicts across Africa, and also the role that natural resources play, because in many cases, our sanctions were connected to the illicit trade in natural resources. So I had never been exposed to any of these issues, and they were just super fascinating. And so I, I had this experience at the time. My wife was at the State Department and was traveling, and I had been there for about a year. And I remember my older son was maybe, I don't know, 1.5, 2, mm-hmm. and was, of course, like, the first time he got sick was when she was on a trip.
Of course.
And so in addition to like not really wanting to be home with a sick 2-year-old by myself, it was the first time I experienced, man, I really wanted to go to work today. Like there was there were a couple of meetings and there was a project we were working on and I was excited about it. So it was that first moment of this is, I often call it first person work, where like we're working on behalf of we, the United States, the American people. And I felt that and really wanted to be there and knew like, okay, this is the right lane for me.
Yeah. So that's cool. Sometimes you find the work and sometimes the work finds you.
Yep.
Okay. So since you've mentioned that you worked on sanctions, and I think few people really understand sanctions, let's do something very brave and talk about sanctions, but we're going to make it cool.
Okay. All order. I certainly agree with you that very few people understand sanctions.
Yes. Give us a master class.
Let me try. I don't know if this is cool, but sanctions are often talked about as behavior change, right?
Right.
We're going to change the way things work. And that's big and hard. Sanctions are, I don't advocate violence, but sanctions are a punch in the face.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about how they are disruptive, when they work best, they disrupt behavior, not change behavior. So the first thing to know about sanctions, if you're hearing something in the news or elsewhere, is when they say we're going to change the way Russia or Iran or someone else works.
Right.
That's where, you know, our former agency, the State Department, actually comes in. That's where diplomacy and negotiations come in. If we don't have a policy, if we don't have an objective, if we're just mad, sanctions aren't going to work. Sanctions mm-hmm. are disruptive, and they're meant to be disruptive by punching someone in the face and then saying, when they get up off the floor, okay, now we're going to work together to change the way this works. And sometimes you have to do that a lot.
Yeah.
You have to be.
You know what it also sounds like, though, Brad? It sounds like kicking in the door. Like, that's what I'm picturing. So it's like you have to have a team to follow with a plan.
Yep.
If you're going to kick in the door and then do nothing else, like, what is the point?
Yeah. And if you're just sending, I mean, you hear people often say sanctions are about sending a message. No, that's when they fail. You have to have, because you kick in the door and then you run away.
Right. Like,
what's the point of that? So you got to kick in the door and have people there to say, all right, now we're going to sit down and do this. We have a plan. So the way I'll make this cool, though, is to think about, so the most important thing that's ever come from DC is not government or policy. It's hardcore punk and the scene around the record label Discord. I'm a huge music fan, as you mentioned at the top.
Yeah.
And maybe the most famous of the bands that come out of that scene is the band Fugazi, which has maybe their best song, arguably, is a song called Waiting Room, which I cite to often when I give speeches. I don't think Fugazi, when they recorded it, was thinking we're going to be recording a sanctions compliance anthem. But that is exactly what they did. And they have in there the lines, I won't make the same mistakes. I know how much time that wastes. Function is the key. Mm-hmm. And I always come back to that as, if there isn't a policy objective that's achievable, that you can actually get to with, when you kick in the door, when you punch someone in the face, if you can't achieve what you're there to achieve, then sanctions are the wrong. So mm-hmm. if we think about when they work, sanctions don't stop wars. Sanctions don't change regimes. They don't. It's very hard for sanctions on their own to, they are a piece of the puzzle of these big pieces, of these big objectives. And it's often just very hard. When the objectives are smaller and more tangible, sanctions can play a much more direct role. So I think, I mean, the Iran nuclear agreement, the JCPOA, mm-hmm. is maybe the textbook example. The criticism of it was that it wasn't big enough and it didn't go and cover every issue. The response to that is that's why it worked. And there was a sanctions plan that went on for 7 or 8 years. These are really, it takes a long time. Again, like, it's a lot of punches. It's a lot of door kicking in. But if you're willing and you're committed to it, then eventually you can get to the table and say, this is why we were doing this. This is why we stormed into your house, stopping Joseph Kabila from changing the constitution of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and like all of his neighbors had done, and running for a third term.
Yeah.
We had a plan. We had sanctions, and he didn't run. Now, there were lots of reasons why. There always are. It's not a straight line, but it's important. Degrading the Myanmar junta's ability to fight on the battlefield. We had a really important series of sanctions actions in the Biden administration for 2 years that had an effect, and they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
The junta's still there, so people will look and say the sanctions didn't work. Wrong. Sanctions worked at what they could do. I think the broader policy
as one tool. Yeah. So then, what?
I don't know
what
if that about? Was cool, but
no,
I,
that was honestly. I've been in a lot of meetings involving discussion of sanctions, and that was the best I've heard.
Okay.
So
maybe
pretty,
that's a low bar,
pretty
but,
good.
I appreciate getting over it.
But then help me think through, what about when they're not working? What if you're using sanctions and they're not working effectively? How do you then reverse sanctions or course correct or change the policy without undermining the tool itself?
So we're not very good at that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think it's something that I'm spending a lot of time thinking about generally, is how do we acknowledge when things aren't working, when we had a good reason to try something and it was the right policy decision at the time, and then It does. It's just not working. And so I had the opportunity, along with obviously many other colleagues, but to start a process that we finished in the during the Biden administration of taking down the Zimbabwe sanctions program. The Zimbabwe sanctions had been put in place in 2003. Pretty early days for the way we think about sanctions in a modern level of like naming and individual people and companies rather than targeting countries, which is the way it had been done. And they targeted hundreds and hundreds of people. And they, instead of doing a series of like escalatory punches, they just hit everybody at once. And basically over the course of 20 plus years, I mean, those sanctions had an impact. And actually you can point a line to the late 2000s and Mugabe losing an election in 2008. Sanctions played a role in that. But the policy didn't get far enough in actually ensuring that there was a transition. He held on to power. Mm-hmm. So he sort of withstood the punches in the face and the door kicking in, and then basically got up, and there wasn't enough policy around it. Again, there's lots to be said about that. But over time, the policy, that tool stopped working. Right. And so we led an effort. It took 18 months, but in March of 2024, we pulled down the sanctions program. And, you know, we didn't say this failed, but we did say the tool no longer works. The policy, our policy objectives are still the same. Our policy on Zimbabwe is still the same. We now have a different kind of sanctions tool called Global Magnitsky, which targets human rights and corruption abuses. Yeah. So we're going to use that tool. It's not Zimbabwe specific. We take away the national emergency related to Zimbabwe, and we're going to target the corrupt and actors and human rights abusers in Zimbabwe through this global approach. Mm-hmm. And implicitly saying after 20 some years, it's not delivering what it might have delivered. And we have to be able to be flexible. It was unfortunate that when we were going through that process, there were lots of, the questions were good about, is this the right decision? But we didn't have models to go back and say, well, we actually also pulled down this sanctions program when it wasn't working. We should be better at that. We should be better at acknowledging we tried this policy tool. It's not working. We've had this person on the sanctions list for 10 or 15 or 20 years. Why are they still there? Yeah. Are they feeling any effects, or have they actually been able to create an evasion and a black market network that's actually better for them? So now you hear this all the time from sanctions critics who say, well, you've made a martyr out of the target, and now they're actually richer than they were before. That's not untrue in many cases. So how do we use sanctions more nimbly to be able to stay ahead of those networks? Yeah.
And to preserve the value and the utility of the tool itself too.
Right. The more you keep using it in the same way and it doesn't have the necessary impact, the more people say this isn't working.
And if you just keep kicking doors because you're just trained to kick doors, you don't stop to think about it. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think a lot of people listening will have a better understanding of what sanctions are and importantly, like what they're not as well.
Yep.
Okay, so you've been in and out of federal government over the past couple decades, and a lot of public servants are now finding themselves on the outside, whether they chose it or not. What would you tell your friends and former colleagues about navigating the private sector, applying for jobs, living on the outside?
Yep. I think, you know, a few things come to mind. The first is to think about, you know, as I said before, people, when we're in public service, we're usually there because we care about the substance, right? We care about the country we worked on, or the, you know, the aid we were delivering, or the, you know, the many different exciting things that we get to do as being part of the American government. The important thing, the realization should be that probably when you're applying, unless you're applying to someone in the private sector or the civil society world that worked on that same thing, that knows you from that, you've got to really focus on the skills you developed. And I would say, in having worked now in all these contexts, people in public service, I've only worked with a few agencies. There's always poor performers. There's always dead weight, et cetera. But so many people I worked with in government are often way more effective and way more skilled than people I've encountered in the private sector. And I think people don't give themselves enough credit. And because there's been a decades-long effort to say public servants are parasites, they're the problem, we kind of undermine and denigrate our own skill set, and don't do that.
And I don't want to interrupt you, but I also I want to add to that public servants, as you said, are so invested in the work and so focused on getting a lot done with very little that public servants are not necessarily masters of telling their own story.
Correct.
And convincing the public that indeed we serve your interests. And this is part of the inspiration for this project, is helping public servants now with time and space to tell their story. But I mean, honestly, do we want our public servants to spend our tax dollars just like talking about what they're doing, or do we want them to get the job done? And that's a hard question. But you're right. Helping people translate those missions into like the hard skills that they've actually accumulated throughout that service is so important. So please go on. I interrupted you.
No, and I'm glad you did, because you've done so, and the guests you've highlighted, I mean, in your own story and your own arc from being outside of government to wanting to come into government tells a lot of that. But the guests you've highlighted also show that in all kinds of different ways. And so, and because it is rare in public service that you can say, like, I did that, right? It's usually... You know, maybe it was your initial idea, but you need lots of people. And that's a really important skill. I think people in public service are uniquely able to work with others to sort of understand different perspectives and how to bring equities together. Mm-hmm. You know, we all kind of, I don't think anybody who leaves government actually misses the clearance process, but I often miss the clearance process because I
actually miss it a little bit too, because I felt like I found my fellow nerds in the clearance process. I'd be like, 100%. I loved your edit on line 3 of that document.
And because I didn't think about that, or you're right, we have to do that. Or it helps you navigate a big institution that's trying to do, you know, enormous amounts of work every day. And you need that input. So that ability to collaborate across functional areas.
Yeah.
The private sector is also very siloed, and actually people in public service know how to navigate across silos and across things much better than they give themselves credit for.
Yep.
The ability to write efficiently and be, you know, if you work at the State Department, you've got, you know, 14-point font and one page to get, you know, a 20-year crisis whittled down to like 3 points. Like, that's really hard to do.
Yeah.
The one advice I got from a senior person in at a big company was... people in government are almost uniformly better at giving advice to senior decision makers than people in the private sector, because it's often not ingrained in the culture of a company. Companies are, you know, again, very layered, and you do your thing for who you report to, and that person does their thing for who they report to. And if you're, you know, at a kind of mid-level job at this at a company, you're not sitting down with the equivalent of an undersecretary or a deputy secretary or even an assistant secretary on a routine basis to say, I wrote this paper for you and here's what I think. But if you're in government, you're doing that a lot. And that's that can be valued if you frame it right. The ability to manage teams, to manage lots of money, and to manage yourself in a crisis. I mean, on Wes Rist's episode, he talked about like thinking he was going to be a doctor, being in the emergency room, and realizing that he was really good in a crisis, and that would translate into eventually into being in government public service. If you work at the State Department and the National Security Council, at the Treasury Department, at other agencies, labor, you're often dealing with immediate urgent issues all the time. And the ability to sort of navigate that is really, those are not skills that you develop. It's one thing to develop them when, okay, you know, our company has a reporting deadline or it's earnings season or whatever, but like people might die if we don't get this thing done.
The stakes are different. The stakes are different.
Very different.
And I think you also learn to think about and weigh your words so carefully that I actually have noticed a lot of people leave government, and I struggled with this too, leave government and then find that it's actually really hard to take that filter off and realize like you can speak freely now as an individual and your words are not like representing the United States government's policy on X issue anymore. And you know, the implications are not so great. You're not going to start an international crisis because you have an opinion on an issue. But when you're in government, there's a lot there that you have to consider, and every angle is so important.
Yeah. No, I think, and weighing that is, you're right. I mean, to some degree, getting that burden off helps you kind of be nimble or flexible in a different way. I was a finalist several years ago for a job at a big, well-known company in their human rights section. And I didn't get the job mainly because I didn't want to move out of D.C., which would have been required, but they also, at the time I had been in government, and then I was 6.5 years at an NGO that was doing a lot of cutting edge work and follow the money investigations and public reporting, naming people who had done what we thought were bad things. And the company's response to me was, we don't know that you're going to be able to navigate the challenges of working in a corporate setting where people aren't always nice to each other. And I just said to him, like, are you kidding?
Excuse
like,
me?
Have you worked in government or in the private? Like, imagine doing everything you're trying to do and more with no resources, no time, and surrounded by colleagues who all think like they're there to save the world. And like, and all the better for it. Like, we should all care that much. But talk about, you know, places that are not for the faint of heart, right?
Right.
And I think you can often, you know, that is also an important skill that you bring. It's hard to translate that onto a resume, but in your interviews, when you get asked, how have you dealt with a complex situation? Most people in government have dealt with situations that are way more complex and frankly, often nastier than what you're dealing with in the private sector. And you have to navigate that and remain colleagues, right? Like, you have to maintain trust in the sanctions coordinator's office, and even more when I was in the Economic Bureau before. You know, my bureau and my assistant secretary had fundamentally different views than another bureau.
Yeah.
And my working level counterparts and I, even though our bosses disagreed and were fighting it out, and they were fighting it out in front of the secretary, I had to maintain a good relationship with my counterpart and in the other bureau and say, like, what's your boss going to say?
Right.
And here's what my boss is going to say. And here's what they think. And here's why. Because at the end of the day, your goal is to get to the right answer. Like, you want the secretary to get to the right answer, not the answer that your boss is pushing. Because sometimes your boss is wrong. And that, I think, learning to understand that and to value your colleagues and respect your colleagues and keep learning from them is another unique part of public service, which is because in companies, you're like, who's making money for us and who's not? And who's a part of the corporate vision and who's not? And it's a much more simplistic approach. And I think government has a lot to offer that. So really lean into the skills that you've developed. Make sure your resume and your LinkedIn profile tells the story of like the skills that you have in managing, leading and navigating and getting to ultimate policy solutions. And when you had the opportunity to influence senior decision makers, those are the stories I think that resonate with. They might not get you through the AI HR filters in the same way.
That's
a whole other question. A whole other problem, but make your connections with human beings who are doing interviewing and understand. Because, I mean, the one thing, I mean, you said it well, we don't do enough in government to sort of tell what we're doing. And there's lots of reasons for that. But I do think it has led to a world in which people do not understand what government is doing for them, other than like the mailman or, you know, the person in state government or local government.
Right. What you see. And like, also, sometimes the work that people are doing on your behalf, you don't see it because they've been successful. And that's often the case, like with foreign policy. If you don't have to worry about an issue because it's been handled by the experts, that's a gift. But now I'm going to blend the last two questions into one, because I actually think they flow pretty well. We've talked about the fact that we've both moved through our careers kind of seeking not just what we're capable of doing, but what we really enjoy and find interesting. And you've talked about how important music is to you and how it's kind of been a part of your process of self-reflection, introspection, discovery. Can you tell me a little bit about the work of self-discovery and career? And tell me a little bit more about the Changemakers Retreat that you and your wife are planning, and lead that into what your hope is for the future, how this is a part of making a better future.
Sure. That's a big combined question. Do my best.
You can do it. I know you can.
I mean, I think one thing I've had to learn, as we've talked about a little bit, when I've gone out of government, back into government, into NGO world, where I was advocating to government, being in the private sector and trying to translate government to people who are frankly skeptical and often annoyed at government.
Yeah.
And sometimes rightly so, is again, being back to that process I had when I was a law student living in the West Bank, is really understanding why people have a certain perspective and understand why the perspective I thought I had might be wrong or why mm-hmm. I didn't have enough information. And how being open and vulnerable to say, we were wrong, I was wrong, is really a powerful, it's a powerful reflection. We're not willing to do that enough because in the polarized, often toxic society and city that we live in, if you say mm-hmm. you're wrong, the other side seizes on it and, you know, it's, and you're in deep trouble. That's too bad because we need nuance and we need the ability to say, I was wrong. I often, the other lyric I quote in almost every talk I give is from Chance the Rapper, who said in one of his early mixtapes, sometimes the truth don't rhyme. And that's maybe my favorite lyric ever because, yeah, like things are messy and they're hard.
Yeah.
My wife, as I said, worked at the State Department. She was a really, really talented but miserable bureaucrat and diplomat. She won a very prestigious award from the, she was in the Refugees Bureau and that sort of family of bureaus at the State Department. And she was awarded that by Secretary Clinton. And literally the next day she left because she realized she worked on refugee issues across the Middle East and South Asia and realized she wanted to be making a more personal level of impact. So she's become an acupuncturist. She now works with plant medicine and, you know, is really helping people. And I often sort of use this analogy about her that that translates into the policy world, which is people come to her as an acupuncturist and say, like, my back hurts, right? And she'll say to them, the work she wants to do with people is, you know, I can give you some needles and maybe your back will hurt a little less, but what if we go on this deep journey to understand everything that's happened in your life and the trauma you've experienced, the pain you've experienced, and how that's connecting to why mm-hmm. your back hurts? And, you know, most people, especially in Washington, are like,
yeah,
thanks, but like, can you just make my back hurt less?
Right.
Give me the needles? Like, I don't want the whole journey. And I think about that often in policy things I've worked on where, as we talked about before, we could go back and say, you know what, we got that wrong. And we caused ourselves pain or pain happened as a result of that, or we made mistakes, or there's a lot of trauma and pain that people in that particular place are dealing with. We need to understand that. And normally in policy, we're just like, you know what, here's a couple of deliverables. Here's a couple of things we can do now. We can throw on sanctions and we'll feel better, or we can whatever the simplistic approach is, we have to go deeper. So what my wife and I have started to think about, and now, especially with a lot of public servants being out of work, questioning their work, seeing that the work we thought we achieved didn't necessarily achieve it. I mean, I've been posting a lot about the need for senior officials from the Biden administration to be more honest and open about what we got wrong. Mm-hmm. And I take my wife's approach to like, let's rip it all open. Let's see where the trauma and the pain is. And let's think about, well, what policy solutions are we missing? What are we mm-hmm. not doing? What is our own fear of saying I was wrong about that, or I didn't understand that, or I didn't listen to that edit. I didn't listen to that community. When we do that, if we're not willing to do that, we're going to miss the bigger solutions. We're going to, in the future, we're just going to go back and say, let's just put back in place everything we had in 2024 later.
Yeah.
That's not good. We need to be able to say, like, there's a whole world of policy solutions that we were unwilling to go down the world of.
Yeah.
And my work, I think what I'm trying to do internally with folks is get people to do that in the DC policy speak. And what my wife is trying to do is get people to do that, not just in their work, but in their whole lives. I mean, you always start by asking people where they came from, their childhood. Like, that's where you got to start. So the Changemakers Retreat idea is for people who devote our lives to the external, to pushing outward, mm-hmm. to joining another association or club or writing mm-hmm. another article or making another post or putting in another weekend of work to write another policy paper or come up with another initiative. My wife would always say, like, it's great that you're doing all these things. I do a lot of other volunteer work and put myself in the middle of lots of policy issues when I was in government. And she would often say, like, it's great that you're doing that. You're missing the solutions you could be coming up with if you just did a little less and took some time back and reflected.
Yeah.
A lot of other things would come open. So come with me and come on a retreat and do this work. And, you know, as usual, she was correct. And I've been on one of her retreats and done work with her and realized, yeah, I was missing a lot of things. I was just going back to the things I knew because that felt safer and that felt
easier. Yeah. This is so powerful. And this is honestly my favorite thing to think about and to talk about, and kind of summarizes, like, I think you just summed up like the great tension of my life, because I've always felt like I needed to do something to try to make life a little bit better for other people. And I think that's like the root of so many people feeling called to public service. But then the how is the big question. And as you're saying, like, there are a lot of things that have been tried before, but certainly we haven't tried everything before. Mm-hmm. And thinking creatively and finding new ways of doing things does require time and space and reflection. And sometimes I think in the policy world especially, we often think we don't have time. Like, oh yes, it would be nice to meditate on that, but I don't have time. I'm under pressure from this leader or from this organization. And unfortunately, if you don't spend the time healing, you will just spend the time sick.
Right.
And like, that's true in our personal lives.
Yeah.
But it's hard because in American culture, and then zoom in, like it certainly in like DC culture, it's really uncomfortable to not be able to like assign labels to things like, oh, I work at this organization under this title doing this work, and this is why it matters. It's really hard not to be able to like box that up neatly for people. And my own journey has been trying to resist kind of the cultural pressure to do that in order to do more of what I feel pulled to do, like where like the vibrations are bringing me.
Yeah.
And so I think it's amazing that you guys are creating a space for people to take that time, do the discovery, to actually be more effective in whatever they choose to do.
Well, thank you for saying that and that own reflection. And that's really, I mean, to honor you and this podcast and the project, and I like that you call it the Public Service Project podcast. Mm. It's really an effort for people to tell their stories, but inevitably reflect on their own. I mean, I've learned so much, and I imagine where you started on this podcast and sort of what you thought you knew about public service and public servants has probably changed radically over the last number of episodes, and how you've been able to hold that up and reflect that for people, I think is so important for the broader community and the broader world, but also for the people themselves to be able to, because as you say, like, it's rare that any of us have the time, and I because I'm married to someone who makes me have the time, like I've learned it. But other than that, most people are like you said, I'm too busy. I'm under this deadline. I'm this.
Yeah.
I have to like remind people that this is who I am.
Yeah.
And often those deadlines are, you know, as we know in government, most deadlines are artificial.
Right.
And we do need to be able to build in the time. And I wish there was more opportunity for those, you know, I think about, I mean, not to criticize them, but you know, the policy planning office at the State Department was supposed to be the office where people like aren't caught up in deadlines and think big thoughts and help us think differently about ways. And so often, you know, I mean, some people did that, but often people in that office were just caught up in the same way, right? Because it's so hard to fight the treadmill, right?
And get it's off. So hard to imagine what could be when you're so deeply immersed in just what is.
Yeah. And when you care, I mean, again, as we talked about, like, we care about these things in public service when, you know, the subject of your sentences is the United States, like, and the United States believes, or the United States will do this. It's an awesome responsibility and super scary, and you don't want to get it wrong. And, you know, again, that leads us to being a little bit more timid and fearful sometimes, or sometimes really bold and brash and also making mistakes. But really that ability to reflect is super key. And so we're hoping to hold the Changemakers retreat in the fall, maybe in the winter. We were hoping to do it in the spring. And frankly, too many people that we were hoping to have had their jobs either cut or were uncertain. And so we also want to curate it in the right way. So I'm happy for people to reach out to me and to be in community and conversation with folks to help curate this together, because this also isn't going to be an offering. The retreat isn't meant to be an offering of like, we know best and here's what we want to do. Like, we want this to be a community. The idea of the calling it Changemakers isn't also just about government. It's about people working locally and doing all kinds of different, everyone's making change somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But also to then maintain a connection and a community of people who've been through that experience. And it's going to be a lot of modalities of healing during the retreat. But then stay together and exchange and share and continue to support one another and kind of build up that trust.
Yeah.
And I think if we can create communities where people can be messy and ugly we're going to be in a better place over time.
Yeah. I mean, humans are meant to be in community. We're social creatures. And so right. I think it's really beautiful that you're doing that. And by the time that we're ready to air this episode, we can also share whatever you're able to share at that point about the ongoing planning and how people can get involved. Because I think there are a lot of people out there right now who are looking for the opportunity to change what they're doing, to reflect and maybe chart a new course. So thank you for offering that. Thank you for taking the time to sit with me and be so honest and open and frankly vulnerable in this conversation. You're also setting a great example for others and thank you for explaining sanctions.
I tried.
You know what? You did it. And I also want to just thank you for your public service. I know that you invested a lot of time and a lot of energy, and I appreciate everything that you've done for our country. So thank you for that, and thank you for joining me today.
Again, it was a super privilege to be included among the amazing guests you've had. And as I said, thank you for this work you're doing and allowing people to tell their stories and to tell your own story and share your own journey through each episode. It's really important. And, public service is getting a lot of... is under a lot of scrutiny and getting a lot of criticism. And I hope people, younger folks who are thinking about it, see it as still something. There is a way to find it that's honorable, because there's just nothing quite like it. And so
yeah.
I'm grateful to you that you're creating this space at a moment where we might have gone more internal and even actually done less. You're allowing it to be exposed and public. And again, not that it's all great and shiny and wonderful, because it's not. That's okay.
Yeah. Well, you know what? We're here to just tell the truth, and sometimes it doesn't rhyme, right?
Love it.
All right. Thank you, Brad.
Thanks so much. Take care.